Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the Mobiltism Method series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobiltism Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobiltism Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Jovan Scott-Lewis, Associate Professor and Chair of Geography at the University of California, Berkeley. We will be talking about his book, Scammer's Yard, The Crime of Black Repair in Jamaica, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2020. Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So at the New Books Network, we like to start our episodes by getting to know our authors. So can you tell us about your interdisciplinary background across anthropology, geography, Black studies, and if there's anything else I'm missing?
Yeah, sure. You know, and it's, you know, I am a Caribbeanist, right? And I think as a Caribbeanist, you understand your problems, right, as being inherently interdisciplinary. I was trained in anthropology at the London School of Economics, but still focusing, you know, on the Caribbean. You know, when you are trying to form questions, right, around the region, you know, it demands, right, attention to, you know, multiple modalities, right, of inquiry. And because the Caribbean has a very rich history of you know, the production of knowledge, right, that takes on so many different forms. So literature, right, art, right, of course, social science, you know, and so there is a need to kind of pay attention to all of that. So, you know, the specific questions of, you know, about the disciplines that you bring up, that you mentioned. So anthropology, so I'm a trained anthropologist, right? I come to geography really by way of my on one hand, you know, the Caribbean is inherently a geographically oriented problem space, right? So that is a foundational geographic orientation, you know, around my work. But I also, in terms of the discipline proper, right, that comes into being for me around my appointment, you know, as an assistant professor in geography at UC Berkeley. Several years ago, you know, I was hired through a call here at Berkeley to help run an economic disparities research cluster. And as a result, I was able to choose my appointments. And what I chose, right, was a joint appointment at that time between the departments of geography and African-American studies. And I chose geography because there was, at least in our department here, you know, there was an attendance to questions of political economy, right, to the questions of development that were a part of this, you know, my department's tradition. And that resonated with me because, you know, they were asking at a department level, or at least they were invested at a department level in the kinds of questions that I was asking. And so, you know, for that reason, I felt very comfortable in, you know, UC Berkeley geography because it felt very much like UK, you know, social anthropology. It felt very much like UK, you know, geography, you know, and so Black studies, you know, Black studies, again, is this foundational, you know, like Caribbean studies, you know, Black studies is a foundational epistemological commitment that I have, right? And this is way before I, you know, began my formal education and my formal training. So, you know, Black studies as an area of inquiry is necessary when you're thinking about Caribbean formation, because it brings up all of the questions that help us wrestle with, well, what does the Caribbean mean, you know, as a product of racial capitalist modernity, right? What does, right, the Caribbean mean when we think about it, as Sid Mintz and others have argued, you know, as one of the initial sites of the, you know, experimentation of racialized labor, you know, in the West, right? So, you know, Black studies has to, you know, has to be a part of that inquiry. And so, you know, if you're thinking about questions of labor, you're thinking about questions, you know, of social domination, if you're thinking about questions of resistance, you're thinking about questions, you know what I mean, that have really at the heart of it, the inquiry of what it means to be Western and modern, Black studies has to be there. And it's important as well to note that really at the heart of Black studies is Caribbean studies. That's my position at the very least, right? So when we're thinking about, you know, so many of the common references that we have in contemporary Black studies, whether it's Fanon, whether it's Glissant, whether it's Sylvia Winter, whether it's Stuart Hall, C.L.R. James, right? You're seeing these are Caribbeanist thinkers. This is Caribbean intellectual thought that, you know, really has set, you know, what we can consider as a contemporary agenda for a broader program of Black study. And so, you know, this is kind of the disciplinary, you know, constellation that I kind of think from.
Wonderful. And it's really helpful to know the geographic core of your work. And my next question is about the people who are also at the core of your work. So in Scammer's Yard, you immediately introduce us to Junior, Dwayne, and Omar. And they're so central and they come alive so vividly in your narrative that I got the sense that they're the ones who led you to this project rather than the project leading you to them. So I was wondering if you could speak to how you conceived of this project with them and how they led you to think through the scam.
Sure. Well, you know, so that's partly true, but I want to quickly big up my 98-year-old grand aunt, Auntie Pinky, who kind of celebrated her 98th birthday last month. Because she's the one who actually led me to this project.
Wow.
You know, I had gone to Jamaica, to do a research project generally on the questions of call sufferation, and we could talk about that later. But on the question of sufferation, you know, political economy, you know, in the tourist market of Montego Bay, and I was at home with her one day, and we were sitting on the veranda. And, you know, it's a perfect, you know, kind of anthropological trope, right? From the veranda. you know, and there's a guy who walked past the front gate and he sounded quite curious to me. You know, his voice was nasally. He had a very strange accent. And I said, Auntie Pinky, what's wrong with that man? Why does he sound so odd? And he said, oh, my dear, it's just one of them scamming them up the road. And I was like, what do you mean one of them scamming them up the road? And, you know, I had known about scamming because scamming, you know, had been a recognized, you know, practice, lottery scamming specifically, had been a recognized practice in Jamaica since about late 2007, 2008, you know, and so this was, you know, a couple of years later. But I hadn't identified it as a specific, you know, area of research for me, right? But then when I got to Jamaica and I encountered one of these scammers, you know, by way of Auntie Pinky's recognition on my behalf, you know, it opened up the possibility of meeting, you know, and that guy who passed by was not one of the people who ended up, you know, working with me, but it opened up the possibility. So I have to just give credit where credit is due, you know, Auntie Pinky, Miss Carmen Foster is responsible for Scammer's Yard. But yeah, so, you know, I talk about how I encountered, you know, the scammers who I talk about in the book. You know, I did research with them as part of a broader project, right? So my dissertation, for example, Scammer's Yard is not the dissertation, right? Scammer's Yard comes out of one chapter of the dissertation. And so, you know, I'm thinking about these guys and their practice really as part of a broader set of inquiries around Jamaica's political economic circumstance. And this is the issue of sufferation. So, you know, what I end up doing is, you know, in anthropology, but in fieldwork generally, you know, there's so much serendipity, right, that leads you to your, you know, experiences. And so having met one of these guys, you know, it opened up a pathway for me and it allowed for me to ask questions of them, but questions that weren't necessarily just about them, right? So the questions that I asked of the scammers were questions that I was asking in my fieldwork generally, right? So in other words, what has produced Jamaican impoverishment? How has that been racialized, right? What are the histories that have produced it over time, right? What are Jamaicans doing to reconcile with or to resist or to make life within those circumstances? And these are questions that I ask the scammers. You know, if you look at some of my articles that I produce out of the dissertation, these are questions that I ask of Black Jamaican market women, you know, and I would certainly recommend people go and read, you know, that very first article, Us or Black People Stay. It's not a plug, right? But what it is, it's to say, well, those women have a very, you know, important perspective about, you know, what subjectivities are formed within Jamaican, you know, Jamaican suffragation. So, you know, what I did was I brought those questions to them, and these were universal enough questions for the Jamaican, you know, the racialized, impoverished Jamaican experience that, you know, it wasn't necessarily, you know, terribly novel to the lottery scam. In other words, the scam was a response for these young men, as market trading was a response, right, for the vendors that I worked with in another setting. And so that's, you know, and that's what really drove a lot of the thinking, and really a lot of the politics around the project for me. So yeah, it was really about these guys' everyday experience.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You mentioned suffragation as a concept you work with, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on suffragation and its relationship or tensions with aspiration.
So I argue that suffragation is a way of recognizing what is a very particular sense of Caribbean, but Jamaican ontology. There is a recognition that Jamaican political economic development has been arrested ever since emancipation. And that sense of arrest has followed through the various conjunctures of political action and even accomplishment in Jamaica's history. So emancipation, right, independence, you know, these are moments that, you know, should really, you know, have, you know, ushered in some kind of new sense of liberty, and it did in many ways, right? But the circumstances remain the same, at least largely. And so we're talking about, you know, from 1834 straight up to, you know what I mean, the 21st century here, where so the experience of life in Jamaica, while taking different forms politically, right, the sense of it hasn't shifted. And so that is an ontological, you know, circumstance. And so suffragation is a framework that helps to account for that. You know, the idea is, what does it mean to have aspiration? What does it mean to actually have intelligence and to have, you know, sometimes skill, but to be effectively, you know, contextually, conditionally incapable of exercising those talents? You know, it leads to a kind of frustration, it leads to a kind of vexation. And these are the terms that I use to kind of help to flesh out the sensation of suffering. And so that's what, not just the scammers, but poor Jamaicans are feeling, you know, generally. And I think we could extend that experience, you know what I mean, to other contexts, even the United States, right? Where, you know, impoverished and especially racialized impoverished individuals feel as if, you know, life is impossible. And so that's the sensation, right? And to be clear, it's not a form of pessimism, right? I've been asked, you know, several times if suffragation is a form of Afro-pessimism, and it isn't, right? Because, you know, there is a recognition of one's value. There's a recognition of one's humanity. There's a recognition of one's promise. But that recognition leads to a critique of the environment, a critique of the structures within which one exists, but not of oneself, right? So even Junior is like, you know, a youth like me, a youth with intelligence, how come I'm not able to, you know, it is perplexing. This isn't right. I should be able to have anything I want because I know that I have what it takes, right? And so it's a critique of the environment, and that's why it's really helpful to understand that And so it's not a kind of, you know, an impoverishment of the self, right? It is an impoverishment of one's circumstances. And I think that lends itself to a kind of critique of general theories of poverty, which are typically rendered as individuals failing, you know, in a particular system. And the scammers are saying, no, the system is failing us. And you're like, well, yeah, that's actually how it does work, right? But narratively, we don't seem to always recognize that truth. And the scammers and sufferation, in turn, help us to fully understand the relationality between one's own subjective aspirations and capabilities and the circumstances that one exists within, and how those circumstances actually inhibit, productivity or accomplishment.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think it really comes across that sufferation also animates the people that you work with in this book. For example, you show us that transnational geographies of capital also elicit the possibility of repair. For example, when we think about the crew's work in business process outsourcing. Could you tell us more about the discursive and reparative possibilities your collaborators create within geographies of capital?
Sure. So thinking back to my definition of sufferation, you know, there is this recognition that the circumstances prohibit one's own accomplishment and one's development. And what that leads to is contemplation as to why. Right? It's not just, oh, I guess this is just how life is. Like, no. What is actually wrong with the system? Why is the system set against me in this way? And what that at least leads the scammers to recognize is that, you know, the system is by design, you know, keeping them back. There's a requirement for the system's productivity, right? For capitalism's productivity, that they, right, be rendered, you know, non-productive, that they, you know, be exploited. And so, you know, what that accounts or really amounts to for the scammers is a form of injury, right? Mm-hmm. And what that does is it demands a kind of reparative framework to be, you know, produced in response. And so what they do is they recognize that their poverty is intentional, right? It isn't circumstantial. It isn't a failing on their own part, but their poverty is structurally intentional, right? And necessary. And so recognizing that as a form of injury, right, the scammers indicate that they have to actually, you know, do what they must in that circumstance. And their actions in response, you know, are nothing more or nothing less, rather, than reparative acts. So what does that mean in terms of the broader geographic issue? Well, that takes us back to, you know, the New World Group Plantation School, right? The work of economist Lloyd Best, who talked about the relationships, between the metropole and the hinterlands, right? The geographies of the Caribbean, you know, the colonial geographies of the Caribbean, the post-colonial geographies of the Caribbean, you know, have always functioned as a site of extraction and productivity, you know, for, you know, what we might think of as external economic interests. And this is what the plantations in Jamaica were about, right? And this is what the bauxite mining in Jamaica is about today. This is what, you know, the development of call centers in Montego Bay are about. You know, so the scammers recognize that Jamaica, right, sits in a particular circuit. And it's a circuit that does not engender, or warrant, according to this broader logic that it sits in, investment. Mm-hmm. It is purely extractive. And so, you know, what we see is that we can see that in the other examples, right? Even in North American context, we could see, right, how, say, impoverished Black neighborhoods, right, are sites of extraction, exploitation still, right? We can see through mass incarceration, we can see through everyday, you know, police citation, how, you know, Black spaces continue to be, you know, seen as sites of value extraction. And so this is what the scammers recognize, right? And so mm-hmm. what they're saying to us is that, you know, that fact is injurious, and mm-hmm. recognizing it as injury, it mm-hmm. demands And so they are mounting the scam as a reparative process, as a reparative response, you know, to the ongoing injury of contemporary impoverishment. And I say contemporary very intentional, because they are saying in this moment, we are being injured on contemporary, you know, on a contemporary basis of how we and our circumstances benefit, you know, North Atlantic economies.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. And I love how in the book, you and your collaborators invert the associations of the scam with criminality and show that it is embedded in the reparative logics you were just talking about. So what is at stake in articulating the scam through repair? And what kinds of post-colonial ethics does this form of reparation entail?
Yeah, so, you know, what does it mean for there to be, you know, a criminal repair, right? And you know, again, when we identify what constitutes and qualifies as injury, right, then we begin to be able to more readily identify well, what can possibly constitute as repair, right? I mean, we think of these concepts as being, you know, pretty static, but the scam allows us, and the scam has allowed me to fully understand them in a much more open way. And so, you know, what that means is that the scam is a crime, right? Repair is a crime, because the injury of capitalism is a crime. I mean, it's a simple formula, right? It is saying that the modes of production, right, the means by which, again, you know, North America and Western European economies can flourish and have flourished is by, you know, the process that Walter Rodney called underdevelopment. And that has continued. And so what we know is that repair will never come, right, in response to that kind of system, because, you know, repair would mean, in truth, the complete abolition of that system, the dismantling of that system. And so, again, thinking very logically, the only thing that you can do, right, because, you know, the Western capitalism won't work against its own self-interest. So the only thing you can do is steal your repair. You know, the only thing you can do is scam your repair. But what the scammers do is they say, well, listen, but, you know, what we're doing is we're basically doing the same thing that you do, you know? And so what that means in terms of the ethics is that it brings post-colonial Caribbean subjects to a place of recognition that necessarily moves beyond questions of respectability or attachments to respectability. And perhaps even more controversially, it moves them past any attachment to the notion of sovereignty, because the scammers recognize that, you know, and I was in Jamaica doing field work at you know, during Jamaica's 50th anniversary of independence. And the scamming, you know, scamming was at its height, actually, around the same time. And so what the scam in that context reveals is that, you know, the scammers recognize the limits of sovereignty. You know, the political project of being a sovereign nation yields very little dividend. And so for them, what you have ethically is this movement past what has for a very long time been the North Star of Caribbean political formation, right? Which is this question of sovereignty. And, you know, I think what that did for me in terms of my analysis, right, is that it made me wonder, well, what does repair or reparation actually do to the long-serving ethics that get you to a point of reparation? Meaning, even in North America, right, the driving, you know, and sovereignty in the Black American context, right, doesn't necessarily figure, you know, as centrally as it does in the Caribbean. And I try to think about that a little bit in some ongoing work. But, you know, but surely the question of freedom, right, is at the heart of Black studies, at the heart of the kind of Black political question in North America. So the scammers made me realize that, well, if reparation, right, can disrupt, you know, destabilize the very necessary, very central ethic of sovereignty in the Caribbean, then it means that reparations actually has a much bigger, you know, consequence, right, than simply responding to injury or compensating for injury or being some form of redress. Reparation, right, like emancipation, like independence, is yet another ethical conjuncture that demands the complete reformulation of what it means to be a Black subject. And this is what I saw, you know, kind of, you know, bearing, you know, being borne out through some of the choices that the scammers made once they got what they considered reparation, meaning this is effectively a cash transfer, right? A cash infusion for them was what they qualified as reparation. And so you saw some of their practices and some of their decisions really helping to indicate what a post, you know, reparations subjectivity or Black subjectivity might look like. But even without holding on to that as a precise example, right, it's still, I think, relatively reliably indicated that reparation is yet another moment in which, you know, we will be required to reconstitute and reconsider what it means to be Black. And that to me is, I think, the major, 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 right, consequence of reparation. And that's, you know, to answer your question, or at least the framing of your question, that's what's at stake, right? Is that we have to reckon with the fact actually that reparations does mean that we have to question, you know, the very up until this point, relatively stable, certainly very comfortable notion of what it means to be Black.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And another striking thread in the book to me was how the law responds to this articulation of reparation and what it means to be injured. So what do the legal processes in the aftermath of the scam show us about the relationship between Blackness, criminality, and wealth?
Right. You know, those relationships show up throughout the book and throughout mm-hmm. the history of the scam, right? You know, what's interesting is that I was able to do, you know, so there's like Auntie Pinky, right, on one hand, who kind of helps me identify, you know, the subject of the scammer as an approachable, you know, figure. But there's also the legal context in Jamaica at the time when I began the research that allowed me to, I think, comfortably, you know, approach these guys and have them not be terribly worried about talking to me, although I'm Jamaican and so forth. And so, you know, that did lend some level of access. You know, but at the time, and this is, you know, 2011, 2012, you know, the scam wasn't illegal per se, right? Because Jamaica had no laws on the books that would lead to any kind of long-term you know, long-term jail time. You know what I mean? What they had was a law that said, well, if you can't prove where you got stuff from, then we could at least confiscate, you know, the state could confiscate, you know, those things, or, you know, basically like an unlawful possession kind of thing. But for the act of the scam itself, you wouldn't be prosecuted. You know, so that changed, you know, in 2013, you know, largely, you know, by way of influence of the United States government. You know, because, you know, North Americans were largely the victims of much of the Jamaica Lotto scam. You know, and so that changed. And so what you had was, you know, a kind of criminality or criminalization of the scam that brought it into the more recognizable circuit of Jamaican crime. So we're talking about drugs and guns and these kinds of things. But prior to that moment, the scam represented something of a gray area. You know, and so that really did, you know, from an analytical standpoint, it allowed for some experimentation with some of the gray area, you know, that constitutes criminality generally. And so I was thinking a lot with, you know, with Janet Reutemann's notions of sanctioned and unsanctioned practices, right? And how, you know, they don't necessarily qualify criminal practices, but, you know, the notion of sanctioning, and unsanctioning, right? Something along, you know, the lines of what we might have also, you know, called the formal and informal economies, these kinds of things, made me realize that we could also use actual crime as an analytic in this somewhat more capacious way. And so what that meant was, you know, looking at crime in a more open way, opening it up to kind of see how it could present, how it could, you know, function in different cases, really did lend itself to thinking about racialization, right? How crime, you know, can be, or how an activity can be sanctioned, can be legal, right, when enacted by a certain party, right? And then it moves into the domain of illegality, right, when practiced by another. You know, what that does is it destabilizes, it disrupts the notion of criminality, right? And I think that's not necessarily a terribly, revelatory understanding or realization. But nevertheless, when we think about how it's practiced on certain subjects, it becomes really important to kind of note, right? The kinds of things in the everyday way that some people get away with and others don't, right? And this is what the scam, really, you know, really did show me. And this has everything to do with wealth, right? Meaning the capacity to have wealth. You know, I reminded and I talk about in the book, you know, Fanon has that quote, you are white because you are rich, you are rich because you are white, you know. And, you know, for the scammers, they recognized that they were poor because they were black, right? And so again, if that disparity is the injury, you know, then justice looks like correcting that specific disparity, you know. And so the question is, well, if my injury is rooted in a racial framing, right, then I have to actually think racially in order to correct it. And so that's why white targets became, you know, so important in how and when they identified, you know, the scam as a reparative act. And so it opens up, you know, it opens up these, you know, these frameworks to be able to kind of use in a much more malleable way to get at how, you know, some of these everyday ideations are put to practice, right? And so one example, for instance, is the collection of lead lists and the selling of lead lists. You know, so lead lists, for people listening, right, is just the, you know, the repository of data, right? People's names, telephone numbers, addresses, and other information as well. The scammers would either collect this on their own, they would solicit it, they would, you know, sell it, right? And, you know, the first scammer to be extradited from Jamaica and then sentenced to, you know, 20 plus years, Sanjay Williams, right? He was a leadless broker. So Sanjay didn't actually call people to scam them. Sanjay never directly, right, sat on the phone with somebody and said, you know, send me money, right? What Sanjay did was Sanjay was a leadless broker. He sold people's data and he got 20 years for it. And so, you know, in one of the chapters, you know, of the book, I think it's the third chapter, I talk about this case, right? Sanjay's case, because he's doing, you know, something that is in fact a legal practice, right? This is called, you know, this is what telemarketers, you know, do. And, you know, and so the irony is that here we are, right? And I have T-Mobile as my service, right? So when a call comes in, like T-Mobile now literally puts on the screen of your phone, scam likely. Mm-hmm. Like, scam likely. So is it illegal? Because if it is a scam and we know that scams are illegal, then we shouldn't be getting these phone calls in the first place. But yet what we see every day on our mobile phones is the recognition of the scam and is the sanctioning, meaning the permissibility of the scam, right? And so if a number comes up or if a call comes in and it says scam likely and you pick up the phone, in principle, you are being scammed, right? But yet we see that as being a permitted practice, right? And so the point is that, you know, what Sanjay brings up, right, is that, you know, crime and wealth, right, are so much determined by race, right? And, you know, Sanjay was selling people's data. In fact, Sanjay was a middleman for he was an intermediary between a legitimate legal company that collected people's data. So Sanjay would buy, right, leadless data from a legitimate lead company. And he would then simply sell it on to other people, right, who would use it to scam, right? And, you know, perhaps the crime there is that he knew what his customer base was intending to do with the information. But when we're thinking about the chain of custody over the over those people's data, right? Like, at what point do you say, no, this is where the illegal practice begins? And so, you know, again, not trying to defend anything, but just trying to, you know, recognize the contradictions inherent in capitalism, right? You know, we sit here and we know that every time we ask for an Uber, right, we're exploiting that driver or that delivery person. We know that they are, in fact, working under terms that aren't ideal, you know, but yet we still do it, right? And so there's an ethical question there, right, that criminality, you know, helps us respond to, but the scam helps us to realize is inherently racialized.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I want to follow up with a question about how repair becomes narrative in scammer's yard. So, you know, you make these wonderful points, but it's also embedded in how you organize the whole book. And you organize the narrative arc around what you call the move from sufferation to repair. Can you speak to your goals in narrating the scam in this way?
Yeah. So, you know, writing a book is an interesting thing, right? You want to, you know, you want to put forward an argument. You want to speak to literature that exists in support or in relationship to that argument, you know, but you also want to get at something that feels like an existing truth in the world, right? And I don't mean in terms of like universalized laws and these kinds of things, but meaning that you can actually speak to somebody's experience. And you could put forward something that resonates, that people who you talk about can recognize as being true to them. And, you know, so as I mentioned earlier, right, I was in Jamaica to try and understand this broader circumstance, right? This question of sufferation. And what I saw with these other groups, right, meaning not the scammers, but with the craft vendors and other people who I spoke to, right, was they're being entirely situated within sufferation. There was no recourse, you know, except for what could be some kind of eschatological, you know, afterlife, Christian, Pentecostal, like one day it'll be over, you know, one fine morning when my work is over, I'll fly away home, that kind of thing. The scammers, however, were very different in that they had found a way through sufferation, right? And so I needed to, in order to make the question of reparations meaningful, both analytically, but also, you know, to them, you know, you had to be able to trace, right, what was in fact being repaired, right? And where did some of these issues begin? So sufferation, again, being the ontology of, you know, racialized, impoverished Caribbean life, right, had to be foregrounded. Right. And I did that with a kind of history of Jamaican political economy, because what was clear for me, as based upon the, you know, the responses from my interlocutors, right, from the people that I worked with, right, you know, was that sufferation was economic, right? It was not having the money, right, to pay for your kids' school fees. It was economic, right? It wasn't bodily, you know what I mean? It wasn't necessarily spiritual, because again, people were Christian and people were finding, you know, fulfillment in the church or wherever else, you know. But it was an economic circumstance. And, you know, scamming was also an economic practice, right? And so the argument, you know, there is to say, well, here's a role of political economy, right? So you want to attend to that, because, you know, what I was able to, you know, determine, at least for myself, was that Jamaica's story was a political economic story. Right? It wasn't just a purely cultural story or something else, that, but political economy really is at the heart of the narrative. And so I wanted to do that in a way that also helped to, you know, give account to the development of the rise of the lottery scam, right? And the response to, you know, to the circumstances through the scam itself. And so that was the point. So trying to write a book that accomplished multiple things, you know, simultaneously. And, you know, that's really it, right? It is about, you know, tracing a narrative arc from what we might think of as the origins of one circumstance or a group circumstance straight through to, you know, the point of analysis, right? The object of analysis, which is, you know, which is how are they responding to those circumstances? That was the intention. Hopefully, you know, hopefully it worked.
In my humble opinion, it works wonderfully.
Thank you.
For what it's worth. I was also struck by your engagement with Patwa throughout the book.
Right.
And it made me wonder whether this is also a reparative, discursive tactic mirroring your interlocutors. Can you speak to how you engage with Patwa and whether you see this engagement as method, possibly?
Yeah, so, you know, Patwa is the language that the people I work with speak, right? I mean, you know, Jamaican, English, whatever, you know, however you want to call it. And so, you know, when someone was, you know, someone was explaining something to me, you know, those are the words that they used. And that's just a fact, you know? And I think, you know, what it means to live with inside, you know what I mean, the language of Patwa is really what this question is about, right? And it's about, again, you know, a mode of recognition. Now, you know, the convenience here is that Patwa, you know, is in part English-based language, right? And so there are recognizable words. What there are often are, you know, grammatical differences, right? So at the very least, an English reading audience could understand the words, for the most part, that are written and spoken in Patwa, right? You know, if it's a reparative act, I mean, you know, again, repair is in response to injury, right? And so, you know, there is, of course, a kind of history of speaking the king's and then queen's English in Jamaica, right? Patwa is not spoken, you know, regularly across all classes in Jamaica, believe it or not. But at the same time, you know, it is a form of not just resistance, right? But it is a form of just, you know, genuine native speech, right? And so I didn't take it as being anything more than that. But you know, if anything, the reparative kind of, you know, politics coming at the point where you're saying, well, yes, this speech should be recognized as what it is, right? And yeah, sure, you know, in the actual publication process, there were different debates about, you know, how that should show up. Should I completely just translate, you know, should I put the Patwa, you know, and then put an English translation in brackets, you know what I mean? And I think ultimately what I decided to do was I put, you know, in the beginning of a book, you know, in the beginning of the book, I said, well, look, here are the Patwa terms. Here's what these words mean in English. You study this page and you can refer back to it if you need to as you go through and read the book, you know? And so, you know, I think it's important for that to just be what it is. You know what I mean? Like it is Jamaican language. And if you want to know what these people feel and what they mean, then, you know, as a reader, you should do the necessary work of educating yourself, you know, and you do the translated work yourself. And so, you know, if that's reparative, maybe, I don't know, right? But it is just what we should demand. You know, if we're taking people's experiences seriously, then we have to just do that. You know, and we have to take their experiences not just as serious, but also as legitimate. And if something is legitimate, then it must be seen and recognized as being legible. And so that's the kind of political orientation around the use of Patwa, you know, in the book. It's just a pure acceptance of the legibility of these people's everyday discourse.
I'm also curious about how you positioned yourself throughout your fieldwork. What does fieldwork with the scam look like as you push back against the criminalization of repair?
Okay, so, you know, so I mentioned earlier that during fieldwork, right, at least the majority of the fieldwork, you know, the crime was not technically, you know, criminal in a way that would have prohibited me, or rather prohibited, you know, the scammers from feeling comfortable talking to me. So there was some advantage to, you know, to the kind of legal situation on the ground at the time. But of course, right, I was, you know, unknown to these guys, you know, and I was still, you know, a stranger at the very beginning. These are not people who I knew. So, you know, I had to be very careful, right? I had to be very mindful. I had to be able to find a way to keep distance, right? While still hopefully, you know, gaining enough insight into what they did. You know, over time, of course, you know, I became a known entity to them. I earned their trust and they became comfortable with me, right? If they hadn't, I wouldn't have been able to write the book. You know, but yeah, there was a real question, you know, for me, like, what does it mean, you know what I mean, to be you know, to be, let me be careful here, you know, to not necessarily be witness, but to, and certainly not to be party to, but to at the very least be cognizant of the fact that the people who you are speaking with, spending time with, are, you know, actively pursuing what can be seen, perhaps maybe not in Jamaica entirely, but elsewhere as a criminal act. You know, and the truth is that this is a part of life generally for a lot of people, especially people who, you know, are living in circumstances where, you know, members of their community feel, you know, compelled to engage in criminal acts. You know, what does it mean to be, and we see the consequences, what does it mean to be a family member, right, of someone who's involved in a gang, right? What does it mean, right, to be, you know, related to someone who, you know, is incarcerated, was incarcerated? Like, these are the kinds of intimacies that, you know, respectability tries to flatten and tries to have us ignore. But these are actually part, you know, a part of a lot of people in the world's everyday life. I mean, these are the kinship networks, right? We have all kinds of people who we are, you know, close to. And so for me, I relatively early on, I kind of stopped worrying about that, right? What I made sure that I didn't do was I made sure that I didn't go with them when they collected money, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to go pick up money. I was like, okay, I'll see you later, right? Because I knew that was different, right? And even if something wasn't necessarily illegal in the proper sense at that point, I knew that that was certainly a line that, you know, would probably be, you know, unwise to cross. Nevertheless, I was able to still, you know, go to places where I knew, you know, scammers were collecting money, right? So they were, you know, scammers collected the majority of the money at places like Western Union, MoneyGram, etc. So even without going, you know, to those places with the crew, right, that I knew, I could still, you know, you could still identify a scammer, right, in the line. You could still see what was happening. You know, now that leads to the bigger form of your question, right? Which is like pushing back against the notion of criminalization, right? So I answered part of what it was like to do field work in that, you know, in that context. But you know, the scam wasn't a crime in the proper sense, not just because Jamaica didn't have the laws that made it formally criminal, but for the scammers. Right, it was simply not criminal, right? In part, it was necessary, right? But more importantly, it was a response to what they saw as the criminal circumstances of their lived condition, meaning the fact that Amazon, you know, had a call center, has a call center, right? Or there's a call center that represents Amazon, right? In Jamaica, and was paying, you know, its employees something that would amount effectively to $1 US an hour, right? That's criminal. So that's how capitalism works. Okay, then capitalism works through crime. And so I'm disengaging as a scammer, right? Scammers thinking I'm disengaging in criminality because I'm trying to do capitalism too, right? And so, you know, and so what that meant, you know, and kind of going back to an earlier answer where you open up the category of criminality, right? You make it more capacious, you make it more mobile, you make it more flexible in terms of how it can be, you know, recognized and how it can be assigned. And so this radical politics of unassigning criminality or actually intentionally assigning criminality to an act, right, as a radical declaration of a broader circumstance, I thought to be quite, you know, quite powerful. You know, and that was part of the challenge in many ways in you know, in writing the book, is that, you know, I wasn't trying to romanticize a scam. I wasn't trying to, you know, decriminalize it in any way, because the scammers have said, no, we are criminals because the system has made us criminals. And the system has made us criminals because we want to exist and to function and be productive within that system. And from our vantage point, right, the only way you can, you know, is to do crime, right? Here in the US, you have, you know, these people in Washington trying to increase the corporate tax bill to 15%. Why? Because these corporations are what? Not paying taxes. They are finding legal means to avoid their responsibility to the state. something where if I were to do or to try and find some way to avoid, you know, taxation, I likely wouldn't get away with it. You know, and so the fact that billionaires cannot pay their taxes, you know, is inherently criminal. And so you see the scammers from their vantage point, from their position in Jamaica, recognizing that this is the way that Western capitalism works. And so they are simply taking their cue, right, from, you know, from that, and they are principally just doing the same. And so, yeah, it's criminal, because if you're going to say that I'm doing crime, then you're doing crime too.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, what is next for you? What are some new projects, questions, even courses that you're working on right now?
Yeah, so what's next for me? So I've just finished my second book. It'll be out next year from Duke University Press, called Violent Utopia, which is, you know, really a study of Black life in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know, following but also preceding the 1921 race massacre in that city. And, you know, in that project, I'm asking, you know, some similar questions, right, around, you know, Black community constitution, right, about what does, you know, the violence of American development look like, right, and who pays the cost for it, you know, spoiler alert, Black people, and what does reparations look like, you know, within that context, right? One thing that I do in the project is, you know, going back to an earlier answer to one of your first questions is, you know, I try to respond to what I think as this under considered question of sovereignty within the North American Black experience. And so I use the foundation of Black life in Tulsa in Oklahoma as you know, founded in Indian territory prior to Oklahoma statehood, as a way of thinking about the kind of sovereign formations of Blackness in, you know, in Oklahoma. And that shows up in places like Greenwood, which is known as Black Wall Street, and really does set the foundation for these ethics of prosperity and self-determination. So that's Violent Utopia. That would be out next, I think it's next fall, from Duke. You know, beyond that, I'm thinking about a couple other things. You know, thinking more about reparations. You know, this year, I joined the California State Reparations Task Force, and so we're thinking about reparations, in, you know, what is for me a really meaningful way, because I'm trying to think about, you know, I think about repair a lot in the book, in Scammer's Yard, as a way of thinking about reparations. But here in this, you know, as a part of this task force, we're thinking about actual reparations as from a policy standpoint. And, you know, what I can say is that even, you know, at this early stage, right, I'm seeing some of the insights from Jamaica and from Scammer's Yard, you know, materializing, meaning that there is a question when you are asking what reparations means. There is a question that demands that we do reflect upon the constitution of Blackness. And so we're seeing that here in California, because, you know, there's a bit of contention around, well, who is eligible, right? Who is eligible for reparations in America, right? You know, is it, you know, folks who are descended from people who were enslaved in the United States, right? Or is eligibility open enough where, you know, Black immigrants who might have arrived in the 50s or even in the 20s, right, might be eligible, right? Living in with a century of Jim Crow and post-Jim Crow racism, do they qualify? And so you're seeing that there are these questions that still must be asked, or that reparations demand that we ask. And so I'm thinking about that more particularly from a, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, alongside doing the work with the task force.
Great. Thanks for sharing this new work with us, and we'll be looking forward to this new book and the policy outcomes of this important work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so. We'll see. You know, we'll see. It's you know, I think, you know, the question of reparation, right, the question of repair, right, are really the questions of our time. And so hopefully, you know, we can have, you know, more and more thinking around what they mean and what they can accomplish.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis, for joining us and for your insights.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Aliza Erjan. This discussion of Scammer's Yard, The Crime of Black Repair in Jamaica, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.